This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Lauren Moss, who is a counseling psychologist in private practice, and she is our last guest in our series commemorating mental health awareness. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Amalia. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Moss, one of the wonderful things about humanity is that we're all unique, and our starting point is by no means our end point. Please, can you tell us a little about your journey into the field of psychology?
Sure. It certainly was a journey coming into the field rather than just arriving there. And I think it started, as most of our journeys do, with being a child. I was a very sensitive child, quite aware of what everybody was feeling, and also very curious, always wanting to know what's the story, what's going on. And so sort of as I was getting to the end of high school, thinking about psychology as an option and being told you're too sensitive, you're too emotional. And so sort of thinking that that was valid feedback. And so stories was really something that hooked me. And I was very blessed to have some wonderful history teachers. So learning the power of stories and the power of what people have gone through. And so I decided I was going to be a journalist. That was my decision leaving high school and wanting to tell people stories. And then at the end of my matric year, going through some very significant traumas, which kind of disrupted the path I thought I was on, and ended up studying, rather than journalism directly, I was studying a BA, majoring in journalism, and then took psychology as a subject and fell in love with it. It just made sense. It made sense to my mind, and then started to sort of think about maybe there was a space where people's stories wasn't just about telling people's stories, but maybe about holding people's stories and helping them to make sense of their stories and living through the traumas that I was going through myself, and that some of my friends were going through at the time. It just became more and more apparent what that lived experience was actually doing to us as young adults. And then the path sort of opened up. I remember being told in one of my psychology lectures that, you know, there was a big lecture hall filled with all these first year psychology students. And the lecturer said, you know, it's such a difficult qualification to get into. Only about 5 of you are ever going to be psychologists. And the thought that popped into my mind was, well, why not me? Which surprised me as a thought, I must say. But yeah, that was it. Like, you know, the more I studied it and the more, you know, as you get into postgraduate studies with psychology, they ask you to also get practical experience. So volunteering and counseling, it just kept on pulling me more and more and more into the field, really, really wanting to understand people's lived experiences, particularly around trauma, and then wanting to help, you know, and how can we hold space for people who've gone through difficult things so that they can actually find the love of life again? Yeah, and that was a journey a long time ago. And then because the path into psychology is quite long, the academic path and the qualification and that, just going further and further. And sure, now more than 20 years later, I'm still in love with the field and just how amazing it is when you sit with someone and they share their story with you, how powerful that can be.
Well, yeah. You've definitely invested a lot of time and energy into the field, and you have a very dynamic way about you, like having this aspect of narrative and storytelling, which is so important. I mean, we all live our lives through stories, yet sometimes I think they're underplayed or undervalued, but they're so important. That's who we are.
Absolutely. I think of our brain as this almost a story organ, right? It's constantly making stories or writing the narrative of what's going on. In many ways, sometimes it's the narrative of what we wish was going on but isn't, or what we think is going on, and then what is going on. So all these Layers. I always think of stories as just layers and layers of our lived experience.
And in the lived experience aspect, you unfortunately went through significant trauma, you mentioned during your matric years. But then when you started to work in the field, you began in trauma and sexual abuse support before completing your formal training. And I just want to highlight a couple of stats from a South African perspective. Gender-based violence is a significant issue in this country. Between April 2022 and March 2023, 53,500 sexual offences, including 42,780 rapes, were recorded nationally. And that was according to the South African Police Services. So I want to go back to your early experiences and ask, how did that influence your understanding of trauma and your approach to counseling?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, those stats are shocking. And yet, if we think about how many sexual traumas get unreported, the numbers are even more staggering, in that regard. And I was volunteering at the local police station to get experience in psychology. And the very first person I ever sat down with to counsel was a survivor of a sexual assault. And, and I had these skills I'd been given as a counselor, and these skills to do trauma counseling. And in that moment, I felt that those skills were completely inadequate. We were told to tell the person to tell their story, but to talk about, okay, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened, and to get stuck in these moments, right? Which trauma, what makes something traumatic is that we actually cannot be present in that moment. It's too much. It's too painful. It's too scary. And so our defenses against that is to detach from the moment, to dissociate. And that's essentially the trauma, is that the disconnection from the present moment, from ourselves. And so in that process with that woman, really feeling like the tools I'd been given, instead of being given a knife and fork, was sort of just given this blunted spoon. That's how it felt to me. And that really ignited wanting to be better, to figure out how can we better serve people who've been traumatized, and particularly sexual trauma. Perhaps what might work if someone's had a bumper bashing, or even a veteran who's gone into a war zone. It just didn't seem like it was going to be effective or helpful with sexual trauma. Yeah, and then as the universe, I think, does, it sort of opens up when we're curious. It leads us in those ways. Just coming across people who were also interested in wanting to help survivors of sexual trauma. And so I ended up being involved in the founding of Open Disclosure, which was a nonprofit organization for exactly what the name implied. Open Disclosures was to create opportunities for girls and women, essentially later on, men and males, but to openly disclose what had happened to them. And I went into that space with just the sort of blunted spoon that I'd been taught. And it was miraculous to see that what people needed was not tools. They didn't need techniques. What they needed was witnessing and holding. So that really, I think, started me on the path of actually figuring out what's going on with trauma and what people need, rather than just trying to take traumas and putting them into this recipe book. Or this recipe that we've been taught.
You're so right. There's a tool and a toolkit for everything, but you can't use a blunt spoon all the time. You've got to be selective about what you apply.
Definitely. And psychology at that time was shifting quite a lot. It was the period of sort of moving away from modernist theories into sort of more postmodern theories, where rather than the therapist being this blank slate, the postmodern schools of thought were talking about co-creation of spaces and collaborative therapies. And that really, really appealed to me, because the one thing I could never quite reconcile in the world of psychology and psychotherapy was that blank slate, sitting in the room with someone who's in pain and kind of holding this this sort of blankness. It certainly, when I was the client sitting in pain, didn't work for me. So it's not to say that it's, again, it's the right tool or the right fit for the right person. It didn't work for me. And so really wanting to find out how can we be authentic in a therapeutic space, because I do believe that that's what trauma needs. Trauma needs a real witnessing, which has to be felt, to have your story seen and heard by someone that needs to be authentic. And that, yeah, I think started my sort of academic exploration of more of the postmodern therapeutic approaches, and what now has led to what we understand to be trauma-informed psychotherapy.
One of the things that's just come into mind is the Truth and Reconciliation Committees. And I just want to ask you a little bit more because you're talking about the witnessing of your story. And that, if we think back to that period, very, very painful, but it certainly helped get over the trauma. That was a national trauma. And if you could perhaps just talk through, like, what is it that having your story, your experience witnessed or being seen helps you?
I'm glad you mentioned the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because for me it was pivotal in, I just want to say, humanity's sort of life or journey, and certainly our countries. And I hope we never forget the value of it. If we think about how we understand trauma now, how we define trauma now, is that trauma is the disconnection from self. And like I said, when the moment is so overwhelming, it's too scary, it's too painful, the psyche or the brain disconnects ourselves from what's happening. And in that disconnected space, our mind starts writing stories. And if it doesn't understand what's going on, which very often trauma is beyond our understanding. If you think about a child that's been abused by an adult, that child is that doesn't understand what's happening. It's supposed to trust adults. Adults are supposed to take care of me. So in that moment of not understanding, and then the disconnection from self, the mind starts writing a story. And most of the time with trauma and sexual trauma, the story starts to be written around, there's something wrong with me. So rather than say there's something wrong with this person who's hurting me, there's something wrong with this context or situation where I am now unsafe, we write the story, our mind writes the story, there's something wrong with me. And then the shame starts to build and build and build. And so when we sit on our own with those stories and we wonder, is there something wrong with me? Why didn't I shout and scream well during the assault? Why didn't I, be assertive? All these questions and that sit in this disconnected space. When we're alone, we answer them ourselves with, well, it must be because I'm not smart enough, because I'm not strong enough, because I wasn't this or wasn't that. And it's almost like a closed feedback loop. But the moment we open and we tell our stories and it's witnessed by another person, suddenly there's an alternative reaction to the story. And I think it's quite something when the alternative reaction is not what you thought it was going to be. And that, to me, what comes out in those, in the TRC sessions or hearings, was those alternative reactions, the reactions of tears. I think about Desmond Tutu recounts the story of the mother listening to the story about how her son and other children were killed, goes to the perpetrator crying and hugs him. And to that perpetrator, that was an alternative reaction. It wasn't the reaction that I'm sure he was playing in his mind over and over and over. And that's where it is our shared humanity, the power of witnessing someone's pain and leaning in and saying, that was a terrible thing that happened to you. And you are still you are still a human, and I see you and I love you. Like, it's incredibly powerful, and it blasts apart those narratives that have been written in a way that says, it was my fault, I did something wrong, no one will ever love me if they knew that it was my fault or whatever the narratives are. And so the witnessing is the power. I think, in quite incredible.
Well, thank you for unpacking it because it is something that I have wondered about. I mean, we see things on TV, but we don't necessarily understand what's going on behind the scenes. And whilst we're on this topic of looking at different types of models and therapies, over the last couple of weeks, we've heard about different modalities. And in your space, I know that you deal with neurobiology of trauma, you have collaborative psychotherapy, and then the trauma-informed perspective, which is possibly what we've been reflecting on now. Could
Right.
you please tell us about one of these types of therapeutic methods and just explain how you use the tool?
Sure. I think in some ways it's the different, almost the different levels of working with someone with trauma. So the neurobiology really helps us to understand what's happening inside a person's body and brain when a terrible incident is happening, and then sometimes even more importantly in the period after that. And why having that understanding, I think, is so powerful is that it's the great leveler. Everybody has a brain. Everyone's brain has a limbic system, and everyone's limbic system will override the front of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, will override personality, will override everything, really, to make sure that the organism stays alive. And so it levels the field, right? To be able to say for certain, I know that while you were being assaulted, I know that you could not have done anything other than what you did, because you have a brain and you have a limbic system and you have a nervous system. And we know that those things all respond in the same way when our lives are at or our lives are threatened. And it really, really helps, I think, a lot of people to let go of some of the shame when you can understand that the freeze response is the most predominant human reaction to fear or to having our lives threatened. You know, we talk about fight or flight, but in reality, humans will go into a freeze response many, 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 many times before that will go into fight or flight. We're not really very good at running, and we're really not very good at fighting. And so our evolution tells us to freeze. And that's biology, and that is equal to all humans. And so it's really helpful to hold that knowledge and to share that with someone to understand their responses and to understand the impact in the days and weeks and months, and some people for years after a trauma, why their body is doing what it's doing. So that's the one element. And then in the collaborative space, it's then again about that relationship and about working with someone. I don't know the thing that's going to heal another person. I don't know what that is. I don't know what magical word might bring someone relief from their suffering. But when we collaborate, then it becomes this joint effort between myself and the client to help them. They know what they need, but perhaps are disconnected from themselves and from that knowing. And so the collaboration is a journey together where I can hold the space, help regulate the nervous system, and then the knowing comes, and then that relief can come too. So that's the sort of the two together. And all of that together is part of the trauma-informed perspective of bringing the body and the nervous system in, and then the power of the relationship.
Thank you for sharing those insights. And when I was listening to you talking about the freeze, fight, or flight, I think we like to think that we can flight or fight, but actually, we're stuck in the headlights like deer. It's freeze.
Yeah, it really is freeze. Most people think it's not. And so when it is, they judge themselves, right? Why didn't I? And yet that freeze, and it's a beautifully effective survival strategy, right? We are at the top of the food chain because of it. You know, if there's a lion coming along, if I run, it's going to kill me. If I try and fight it, it's going to kill me. But if I lie really, really still, it's probably going to get bored and walk away. And it's an incredibly effective strategy, but humans do not like the idea of hopelessness, right? Of powerlessness, of just doing nothing. And so we would rather imagine ourselves as great runners and fighters, even though that imagination then hooks us into the shame of why didn't I?
Oh, so interesting. Given what you've just said and your extensive work with women survivors of trauma, or rather, let's say female survivors of trauma, what role do you think gender equality plays in the mental health space and in creating truly healing spaces?
Right. I could say a lot of things there. It kind of gets me emotional to think about it. When I was researching around the lived experience of sexual assault survivors, and I decided to research female survivors specifically, what was staggering was the amount of literature that spoke about victim attribution, right? So what was it that the victim had done to get to this event happening to them? And just the amount of just academic research that had been done on that really, really, I think speaks to the inequality and to how hard it is for society to really acknowledge how vulnerable women are and how hard it is for women to acknowledge how vulnerable they are. Because if we acknowledge we're vulnerable, it makes us feel powerless, and therefore are we not now open to being hurt? And then I think what I have witnessed some of the people I've worked with go through is that sometimes the responses they get from women when they disclose their abuse can be more harmful and hurtful than the responses they get from men. And I think as women, we look to other women, right, to get that affirmation or confirmation of, am I okay? And when other women move into that space of judgment, well, if you hadn't have worn that short skirt, it's crippling. And yet we can understand that those other women's responses are coming from a place of fear. They're coming from, I want to believe that if I control what I wear, if I control how much makeup I wore, if I control whether I'm thin or whether I wear revealing clothes, I can control whether or not something awful like this could happen to me, rather than sitting in the reality that how these bad things happen is out of our control. And so I think in those moments, women can let other women down, rather than hold each other up. That is often more traumatic an experience, is the lack of support post an assault, particularly by other women.
Often I find in conversations there's always some type of theme. And the theme that's coming to mind, it started before we even went online, is this idea of expectations and not having expectations met, and how we have these preconceived notions about how things are. But the truth is, they just are. It's you can be wearing a short skirt. It's not because of the short skirt. Whatever we're trying to think of and trying to rationalize these things, that's our own rationalization. But it's not necessarily the truth of why someone has targeted you. It's their prerogative.
Someone has decided to target someone. Yeah, it was one of the most, for me, meaningful moments was when a client who was a survivor of a rape, she shared it with me. She had seen a post on Facebook, but the post was saying, I was in a bar flirting and dancing with this guy, and we went out to the back and we kissed, and I said, oh no. And he went, okay. And he walked me to my car. And I wasn't raped because he wasn't a rapist. And then, it goes through these different stories. And that's always been so impactful for me. And maybe even in my own story was that really it is when someone decides that they're going to hurt someone, they've decided that. Full stop.
Now, access to mental health resources, can be a challenge. And some women may need professional help, but they might not necessarily get it because they lack, one, the financial means to do so. And secondly, maybe they feel embarrassed to reach out. So if I could please ask you, what types of self-help resources are available that you could refer women to, or even if you could share some practical tips to assist people in taking some steps towards healing and reclaiming their sense of self?
And I think it's such an important question because, in an ideal world, we would all be able to access therapy and those spaces, but we don't live in an ideal world. So I think two things. So one would be, and it's an internal resource, is to really get to know yourself. So spend time being curious about yourself and getting to know yourself, ultimately to fall in love with yourself, right? So I think that journaling is one of the ways to do it. Journaling doesn't have to be these sort of long, writings about your feelings or analyzing things, but rather just spending time with yourself about yourself. People who've taken on the challenge of a year of journaling, the results and the blessings and the learnings that come out of it are quite phenomenal. So spend some time getting to know yourself. I would recommend journaling. And in the journaling, just journal like what you did today and what was interesting. And maybe you watched a movie last night. And what about the movie was interesting? And what will happen is you'll start to get to know yourself. And in that getting to know yourself, there is more of a reconnection with our core selves. And then, not and then afterwards, in other words, but and then find a space where you can be with other humans, where you feel safe enough to be yourself, right? So whether that is a space with family, although many of us do struggle to be ourselves around our families, lots of expectations in that space, with friends, but maybe it's not even. Maybe if there are not spaces of with people, then where else could you be yourself? Where is it safe enough to be yourself? Perhaps it's in nature, in your bath with bubbles, and some candles around you. Perhaps it's with animals, with pets. Be open to that. And then when you can be in a space and you can be yourself, you start to almost come alive in those moments, right? And the more we come alive in those moments, the more we are ourselves. From a nervous system point of view, we're more regulated and more resourced. And then be braver with that, then go into more and more and more spaces. And ultimately, the more you know yourself and the more you feel comfortable being yourself in the world, you'll have more of those moments of witnessing where someone sees you, validates you, maybe falls in love with you. And that is so healing, regardless of what it is that you've survived.
Wow, very cost effective. And tapping into yourself as this reservoir of resource and acceptance and becoming your own authentic self.
We're never not with ourselves, right? It does. It feels like if you think about another person, sometimes they have to go to the toilet. Sometimes they have to go to work. But ourselves, we're there all the time. And most humans struggle with their relationship with themselves, right? And so that's why I'm encouraging the journaling and the getting to know yourself, rather than just saying, "Well, I'm fabulous. I love myself." Get to know yourself, your real self.
So many thoughts, and also the other point that's going to go through to characterize this conversation is certainly the narrative dynamic. Dr. Moss, during our conversation, we've spoken about your different therapeutic modalities, we've spoken about your work, and earlier in the conversation, we chatted about the competitiveness of actually getting into psychology. It really is a very rigorous process. You've guided many emerging professionals through supervision, through guest lecturing. What do you believe is most important in cultivating the next generation of psychologists, particularly women?
Particularly women, yes. I think I'm going to go back to what I am saying, even in the previous answer, was really, I think that the more that we know ourselves, the firstly, the easier that process can be, because it is a very difficult process. But I think that when you know yourself, you're also more open to understanding fit and understanding, this space might be good for me, this space might not be good for me. And a lot of the selection process to get into psychology is a lot about fit. There's some other things too, but also about the fit. And so the more that someone can know themselves, it also means that they can know, you know what, perhaps this wasn't a good fit for me, rather than saying I wasn't a good fit for them. And then interestingly, the more that we know ourselves, it is a part of what the process is trying to find, is that people who are grounded and people who have a strong sense of self, because if you're going to move into the field of psychology, you're going to be holding space for others. And so are you able to hold that space? Are you able to stay regulated? And so the more that we could be doing that, the more that we could come into the field well regulated and well known to ourselves, it'll make that process easier and will, I think, then we bring in all the academic learnings. And I think that we would be, I want to say growing, but that's not maybe the right word. I think the field would become incredibly rich in that way.
Again, thanks for the overview. And I hope that people are encouraged about what you do, the help that you provide, and be attracted into this important healing field and space. We are rapidly running out of time. And as we come to the end of the show, a question I ask all my guests is about some of their factors of success. Could you tell us a few of yours?
What comes to mind sort of straight away, it really is playfulness. And I didn't realize that that was a factor of my success, I suppose, until I've gotten more mature. But really, I can think about times throughout my journey where I really just made some space for some playfulness. Often people will ask, like, you work with trauma and it's such a heavy topic. And playfulness, I think, helps to balance that. And so be willing to be playful. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in your professional life, but in my private life too, finding time for play. It's so rejuvenating. And then I find myself bringing some playfulness into the therapy space. As humans, we need to learn to laugh at ourselves. We really, really do. I think South Africans are brilliant at it. We're so willing to laugh at ourselves and to crack a joke. And it helps. It helps to balance how difficult things can be. So playfulness will definitely be one of them. And then having a support structure. There are times in my life where I've had people around me who were not necessarily good for me. And even though they might have been calling themselves my best friends or even some family members, but they weren't actually rooting for me to succeed. They were rooting for me to maybe not show them up. So not to say they were rooting for me to fail, but for me to not show them up. So I think that the moments where I was brave enough to steer away from those people, which takes a lot of courage, were definitely a part of my success. And then nurturing the relationships of the people who were happy to see me grow, not just happy, but wanted it to happen and took joy out of it, and then strengthening those relationships.
Very, very wise words. And when you were growing up, are there any pivotal moments that shaped you?
Yeah, and I think that the most pivotal moments that shaped me were the most traumatic, and the most difficult. When they say diamonds are made under pressure, facing the death of a friend when I was a teenager. We were involved in a horrific car accident and she was killed. Absolutely shaped me. And dealing with my own sexual assault Those moments were very, very shaping. I think traumatic moments in with my parents' divorce, trying to make sense out of that, all these things, and they shape us. I think we can think that the trauma shapes us in the way that it cracks and it dents and it harms, but the other side of trauma is this knowing that we are resilient, When I went through that difficult time in matric, realizing that I survived that difficult time, that I think gave me a lot of, I suppose, hope in myself or maybe faith in myself that if I could do that, then I can do difficult things. And then again, in my adult life, when there were very difficult times, just this knowing I can do difficult things because I had already survived difficult things. And that kind of has grown and grown and grown, that it doesn't now have to be about difficult things. That's the evidence, but even the amazing things, I mean, like I can do difficult things. And so becoming, I suppose, backing myself up and being in my own corner and kind of like, you've got this, girl, you can do it. And I don't know if I would have known that about myself if those terrible things hadn't have happened.
So it's like you've created the scope for capacity, whether it is a negative event or a positive growing event that you can take things on.
Which takes us back to the narrative, right? To the story, to be able to say, what is the story of how I arrived right here? And letting all of the story in, the good and the bad and the ugly, and it all is a part of it, with everyone. Once we bring in all of the story, it's just all pretty fantastic and amazing, that what humans can do and what we can actually survive.
And using our story analogy, we've had our beginning, we've had our middle, and now we're at the end. So if you could please use this platform to share a few words of inspiration with girls and women who are listening to us.
Gladly. I'm actually going to quote a poem that Nelson Mandela quoted in his inauguration, which is a Marianne Williamson poem, and it means so much to me, but I think that women need to hear it, because I think that we do play small very often to try and protect other people's feelings. And so if I can read the poem, it is our deepest fears. What's called our deepest fears? Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are here for a reason. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. I'll stop there because it does go on a bit, but I think that that's so important. And perhaps I wish I'd heard that when I was younger, when I was shrinking so that other people would feel more comfortable. And so that's the message I'd like to leave.
That is a wonderful message. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights and your journey. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I'm very grateful.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Lauren Moss, a counseling psychologist in private practice.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.